Hello and welcome to Brave Space Live. I literally always do this intro and I'm like, I was supposed to say, okay, what up? Anyway, welcome to Brave Space Live where we have tough conversations about anti-oppression and communal healing. I'm Tyshelle, I'm a diversity, equity, inclusion practitioner. And this is my co-host, Mel.
Hello, I'm Mel. I'm an author and a social ethicist.
Awesome. So I wanted to talk about what our topic for today is: radical self-love, Black and queer joy. And this is our last episode of season three. I can't believe we've made it this far. We'll talk about that at the end. But we didn't want to just talk about it from our mouths. We wanted you all to hear from someone that we both follow, that we both admire their work. I literally just told her I was doing her LinkedIn learning and I was like, I'm not fangirling, but like a little bit of fangirl. Anyway, so we want to introduce our guest. You know her as Madison, the blue-haired unicorn, and Mel's going to read her bio before we bring her on.
Yes, we are so excited to have Madison with us. So Madison Butler is a New Englander at heart, but moved to Austin in 2017. She's an outspoken advocate for mental health, removing stigma around trauma, amen, DEI, and the ability to be a human or at work. She is passionate about facilitating hard conversations through storytelling, data, and tough empathy. Well, she is among friends tonight because we very much share that sentiment here at Brave Space Live. Madison is a startup enthusiast and is passionate about building inclusive teams from the ground up with early stage companies. She's committed to helping change the narrative around what it looks like to be human at work, helping to
Mel, let me just say, Mel said earlier today, I'm a little loopy because I've been working all day and she has delivered on that. But yes, you are. Keep going.
Such a backhanded compliment. Helping to alleviate unconscious bias in corporate America. I got it. If you want to check out her website, bluehairedunicorn.com. So, and there's another statement that she had on her website that we absolutely loved and Tyshelle is going to read now.
Awesome. You can bring her on because I really want to, I think as I read that, I really want Madison. Hi, Madison.
Welcome, Madison. Hello.
Thank you for being here with us. So you have on your website, and it personally is like your, when you saying hello, says, I'm Madison Butler, otherwise known as the Blue Hair Unicorn. I'm Black AF and queer AF and committed to breaking down the status quo and creating environments that allow everyone to thrive. So when we were thinking about radical self-love, Black, queer, and joy, you came to mind immediately. And that, just that quote personifies that. So I could not wait to hear. Tell us a little bit more about you and what brought you to this Black AF, queer AF, and committed to breaking down the status quo.
So my name is Madison. My pronouns are she, her. And I am the CXO of a company called Grav. I also own my own consultancy. I also speak a lot. I also started Black Speakers Collection. I also don't sleep nearly as much as I should. And when I think about like why I do the work I do, it's because I fundamentally feel like work is broken. And one of the things that for me I've examined is we're so comfortable, or at least comfortable, talking about setting boundaries with our relationships, our families, our friends, but we haven't had that conversation about work yet. And so many of us have been asked to trade really big pieces of ourselves in order to have a paycheck, which like at the end of the day, unfortunately, we exist in a capitalistic society. I don't really have a choice. If I had to just like trade berries and like write notes to people to like survive, would I work? No, I would absolutely not, but here we are. And so in that, knowing that work is something that the majority of us have to experience, it seems incredibly unfair that this thing that we didn't really volunteer to do, we also now have to voluntarily shed giant pieces of our humanity. And so when I think about what work should look like, that is why I do the work that I do. That's why I'm at Grav. That's why I spend a lot of time thinking about how do people best thrive. And I can tell you the answer is not when they're scared or when they're pretending to be someone else for 8 hours a day. And that's, again, why I try to spend a lot of, you know, my outside consulting time with early stage companies, because I feel like there's still hope. Like, you haven't.
Like with babies.
Fast enough yet. Like, I could still get in there.
Exactly. Exactly. I love what you're saying there, because that's part of, so my background is in clinical social work, and I was like, I want to work with kids before they become fucked up adults. And then you realize, oh, they're fucked up. Okay. The whole cycle. Okay. But we still work on it. And then kind of the same route I take with doing what can be called in so many different words, DEI, all the things. And part of the reason I've said that is because marginalized people have to work everywhere. So no matter where I'm doing this work, if I can make it better for them to exist at that place, I hope to do so, and then make a living while doing it. But really, that's how I balance how I do my work toward the people, oriented towards the people, instead of centering the dominant group, right? So is it, you have a terrible manager and they don't let you express yourself because you're Black or you're queer or you're marginalized or they're not thinking about you being disabled. How can I make that better for you? And if that happens to educate European Americans or any dominant group in the process, great. So I'm taking your LinkedIn course. I'm going to make other people at my job take it too. So I really, really love that. Mel, anything before I jump into some of the questions that we have and some of the things that we wanted to share about this thought about radical self-love?
I'm so interested in your work, Madison, especially because I and other, you know, millennials or Gen Z people that I've talked to especially have expressed the sentiment of, you know, going to work, especially in any kind of corporate environment, feels like you're cosplaying. It feels like you're putting on a costume of an adult or a white person or a, you know, a man or whatever sort of norms that we're forced to adopt in the workplace in order to be acceptable, quote unquote, right? And we actually had our last episode, we talked the entire time about invisible ceilings, glass ceilings, bamboo ceilings, concrete ceilings, and how those norms function to really make us feel stifled. And it feels like almost literally claustrophobic for me. You know, and I even have a creative job. I'm a graphic designer. So even still, I still feel that. And I think a lot of us feel that parts of us are not welcome in the workspace. And I think it does just crush joy. It crushes our incentive and our drive a lot of times too, because we have to, you know, if we're not just naturally adept at these things from a personality perspective. Yeah. So I love that you're doing this work, and I completely wholeheartedly support it. And I would love to hear the story of how you got into this work, because I sense that there's a good story there.
Sure.
Accident, like most of us, I think. You know, I think that is such an important statement when we think about the act of cosplaying, just to like back up like a couple steps. So code switching is something for me that I'm incredibly passionate about, because I did it for so long. Like, I can still perfectly turn on my phone voice. And don't I sound approachable? Don't I sound palatable? Don't I sound like a white girl? And how many times have people talked to me on the phone with that voice on and have never seen me, because I did work before the world of Zoom. And then they would meet me and like, you could see them being like, wait, but your name is Madison. And I spent a long time trying to be that person. And so that was a big piece of, and I've talked about it before, like I do not use the word professional to describe my career, because my career has nothing to do with society's version of professional. When they have given us the word professional, what they were really telling us was like, lean as closely as you possibly can to straight white men. Yeah. Be as close as you can to that thing. So when they said professional, they never met me. They never met someone who looked like me, talked like me, existed the way that I do. And so I very much feel that you can have a successful career without embodying the way the world views professional. And so to think about how I got here, it was really on accident. And it's funny because we all would have hated 21-year-old me. I look back and it's very like, you know, when you read your memories and you see the statuses you wrote and you're like, oh,
delete.
Oh, God.
Okay, I don't feel like that far on purpose.
Worst. You know, so for transparency, I'm biracial. My mom is white. My dad is Black. That comes with a ton of confusion. It comes with a lot of like, I don't really understand where I fit, especially when you're young. And my parents did what they thought was the best thing for me. From a very young age, they put me in private school. From like the time I was like two, like my mom had me in Montessori and they were teaching me French. You want to know what I remember? Nothing. Zero things. But till the time that I graduated college at 22. And so private school already, predominantly white. And then for high school, I went to boarding school, predominantly white. And then I went to business school, which was not only predominantly white, but it was predominantly male. And so you spend a lot of your time not only seeing success painted to you and your teachers and your coaches as whiteness, you're now also trying to make friends, because I'm the first to tell you, like, being a teenager, being a young adult, like, you're chasing validation because you're chasing community. Because for a long time, it's been your family. And now you're like this free bird. And you're like, okay, I am trying to fall in love and learn how to flirt and, like, learn how to be cute and whatever. And so you're seeking male validation. And so it's so funny to me now, because the body type I have now is, like, absolutely not cool in college. And it's super cool now. Like, super cool now. The men who, like, bullied me in college are, like, in my DMs today. But that being said, chasing male validation, you try to lean into what you think men like. And when you've been presented nothing but whiteness, guess what? You would try to act like, try to look like, try to emulate. So I had pin straight hair. I wore a lot of loafers, a lot of Banana Republic. No hate to Banana Republic. I still very much enjoy their denim. But, like, I wore a lot of blazers, which I know was, like, very in like the 2006, 2007 era.
Like, dressing like we're in the club. We're dressing like we're going to a business casual.
I have a photo. I swear I have a photo of me going out to a nightclub and I'm wearing an Argyle sweater vest. It's horrific. Horrific. But fast forward, when I was 21, I started dating this guy, and he was about 10 years older than me. He was a white guy. And it was one of the things, like, my parents were like, we literally hate this man. And I was like, no, you're just being silly. They were not being silly. They absolutely were reading the room, which I was not doing. Because again, I was young, I was seeking validation, and nothing felt more validating than someone who I viewed as having their life together, being older, being interested in me. And so, to make a very, very long story short, the relationship itself was incredibly abusive, not only, you know, physically, emotionally, and financially, but, like, he was a racist, a whole racist. And it's funny, because when I tell this story, people are always like, how can you be racist? And they date you. Like, being someone's fetish and them being racist are absolutely things that hold hands. And so, you know, I went through not only living with him and then trying to be, like, this other version of me because he hated my blackness. So I'm trying to be anything but, because that's what's keeping me alive and functional. He's also, like, thinking, you know, this is, again, in, like, the come up of the Trump era, like, when Trump was running, when all of us were like, this is absolutely not going to happen. This is not a reality. And as that progressed, like, he not only got more violent, but he got more open with his racism. And being young and also very naive, I was like, oh, what would solve this? We should absolutely move across the country together where I have no community, no support, and everything will be fine. It was not fine. Things were not fine. I very quickly realized that not only did the physical abuse get much worse, I was having lots of moments with myself where I was, like, standing in the shower being like, damn, are you crazy? Because I would see things and he'd be like, no, you didn't see that. That was not real. And so I remember just having this, like, very conscious moment of being like, if you don't leave and get out of the state of Texas, because we moved to Houston, again, not my best idea. If you don't get out of the state of Texas, you're going to die in the state of Texas. And it's going to take someone a very long time to notice, because you have no community here. And my mom is just going to think I'm, like, being a brat and not texting her back or whatever. And so I packed everything I owned, which were my two dogs, enough clothes, left my car, rented a car, drove my black ass back to Rhode Island without stopping, like, drove back. And by the time he realized I was gone, he dumped my bank account. And so I literally had nothing. And when I got home, my mom was like, what are you going to do? And I was like, I don't know. And someone was like, hey, do you want to try recruiting? And I was like, I don't really have a choice. So if I'm bad at it, cool. If I'm good at it, cool. But it taught me, not only am I good at it, because I genuinely love helping people find what they love in work, I also recognize it was very, 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 very broken, but it was very, 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 very broken for specific people and worked very well for other people. Hmm. And so through that, paired with, after we broke up, our breakup made BuzzFeed, which having a personal reckoning while the whole world is watching you is not necessarily my favorite thing, but it was the first time that every article that came out about me, so, like, it was Atlanta Black Star, it was BuzzFeed, it was... the Democrat one. Like, there were, it was on, like, my mom was calling and she was like, they're talking about your breakup on XM radio. And, wow. You know, this whole time I was very, like, not black. I mean, I was black, but I wasn't fully aware. I have an article called Coming Out Black at 25. And that really was what it was. Cause it was the first time that I recognized everything written about me was written about the fact that I was a black woman dating a white man. And I tried so hard to run from my blackness, but it was the only thing that anyone knew about me. It was the thing that entered the room first. And they just made up a bunch of stories. They were like, she's dating him because she needs money. And I was like, I'm confused. Like, y'all didn't even call me. Like, what kind of reporting is this? I have an English degree. This isn't good. But it was the first time that I was like, shit, this thing that I've denied, that I've claimed that I'm not, that I've like claimed that like, oh, I'm biracial, I'm mixed. I'm special, special girl. Didn't matter. And to top it off, on my drive home, I got pulled over in Alabama. And a Sunday morning at 8:30, I'm in my pajamas. And like cop came out, gun out to my vehicle. And so I had a very public coming of age, unfortunately, where I really had to think about like, what is my identity and who am I and why have I run so far from this person? So that is a long story about how we got here, but here we are today.
So how did you, that sounds like rock bottom. Like, I mean, for you didn't elaborate on that, but from what you're saying, context clues, you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure out, like, that sounds like rock bottom. You have nothing. You're back at home. You just had a horrible breakup. You have to move. Like, that's like so many life stressors at the same time. So how did you get from there to radical self-love and teaching other people about radical self-love?
Interestingly enough, now that I kind of think about it, like, I'll walk it back. It's like, I actually don't think that was rock bottom for me, only because there was such immense relief. Like, I didn't care that I didn't have anything because I feel like I truly somehow skipped getting, you know, unalived.
You were rescuing yourself.
Yeah, like there was so much freedom and like I didn't care that I had anything, but I had been with this person, you know, over 3 years where I couldn't do anything. Like everything would start a fight. Like I remember he called me once on the phone to start a fight because I didn't cut his sandwich in the right direction. Like I cut it down the middle and it was supposed to be diagonal. Like there was just this constant fear of like, who am I coming home to today? And I look back now and I didn't think about this then because I'm so young, but nothing would have stopped him from going to hit the local Walmart and buying a gun and that being the end of it, because that is how easy it is to purchase a gun in the state of Texas. And so for me, that wasn't rock bottom. I truly feel like rock bottom for me was when I was sitting in my bathroom trying to like count out the pills that I had, because I had just this feeling of like, I don't want him to get the satisfaction of killing me. And so like, if this is like the end point, like I want it to be something that I own. Mm. And like, I had a file on my computer that was like a, if I go missing file, that was just like screenshots and recordings and like all of these things I had collected because I was so certain that that was going to be the outcome. But that being said, when I think about how did I get from that place to this place, I think so much of why I'm in this place is because I've experienced that place. And so in my brain, I'm always like, if I can help people get here without the trauma, like, whew, I would love to be able to do that. But I think a lot of it was I really started just thinking about, like, why am I not showing up as myself with my family, in relationships, in friendships? Like, I would have never considered having, like, big blue curly hair, like, at any point in this because other people wouldn't have liked it. And so honestly, it was a lot of hard conversations in the mirror, a lot of understanding rejection and being able to think through that, because human nature is not to want to be rejected. We really try to run from that. And this whole time, instead, I was just rejecting myself. And so I really kind of flipped that for me. Like, what do I need to do to accept me and find love for myself? And if that comes with a bunch of goodbyes, then it needs to come with a bunch of goodbyes.
Wow.
And so I just started setting these really firm boundaries in my friendships, my relationships with my family. And it probably took me a couple more years to have this. I had this like big aha moment. I went to an interview in Austin because I did move back to Texas after all of this. And a lot of that was like out of pure spite. I was like, well, you're not going to ruin like my entire, I'm an only child. And so moving away was a big deal. And so I was like, you're not going to ruin this for me. Mm-hmm. And so I moved back to Texas. It's hot and I'm not there anymore. But I had an interview and this company was like, oh, we love you. We can't wait to send you the offer letter. And I was really excited and they followed it up with a big fat but. And they were like, but we need you to take out your nose ring, cover your tattoos, control your hair. That is the term they use. They told me to control my hair and dye it a natural color and that I have to wear skirts and high heels. And I was like, what? Like, I came here in Birkenstocks. Like, I'm confused. Like, what vibe did I give you that I was going to wear heels? And at the time, I remember just still saying, oh my God, thank you so much. Like, send me the offer letter, because we're so conditioned to be grateful when someone wants to work with us. But on my drive home, I really found myself being very like white at the knuckles, like gripping my steering wheel, because I had just like this aha moment of how many times have people wanted to work with me because I'm good at what I do and I can promote their business, but they did not give a single shit about who I am as a person. But the reason I'm so good at what I do is because of who I am as a person. And so basically I was like, for lack of a better term, fuck this transactional shit. I was like, what can I go home and do and put on my LinkedIn so no one's ever gonna ask me to change my hair color ever again? And so I went home and I was like, oh, blue-haired recruiter. And that's basically how this tagline came to be. But I think another really pivotal moment is actually what happened next. I was still interviewing, and this man is white. We were still very, very close, but he interviewed me. And I remember saying, like, just so you know, my hair is blue. And he was like, yeah, I have eyes. Thank you. And that was it. Like, it was that easy. And I ended up working at that company. And through the course of my time working there, he really encouraged me to like dig deep and be uncomfortable with the things that I was saying. Because when I started having these conversations, I was uncomfortable. And that was a really pivotal time for me to have someone who was in a really high leadership role at the time encourage me to like say the hard stuff.
That's so, some of what you're saying, this like I'm pulling from things that you're saying, going, yep, had that experience. Yep, had that experience. Yep, had. I told my niece, I said, when you graduate, she's in college right now. I said, when you graduate from undergrad, you'll graduate with whatever degree you have. And as a Black person, degree in code switching, like a full on degree.
Yep.
And part of how I live my life, and one of the shirts that is on our website is Too Tired to Code Switch. Like, I just don't even, like, I'm trying, but and maybe I shouldn't try, but my personal brand for myself is I'm both an ancestor and a descendant. And I am a descendant of those who came, not just from, I used to start at the Middle Passage, but even before that, who were captured and enslaved in dungeons for months before that even happened. And then how I am an ancestor is I see myself like very, very in my brain, not like outside, but with like carrying a lantern like Harriet Tubman, just to light the path for folks behind me so they can wear a scarf to the dentist's office or a bonnet if they want to, because the hairstyle that I have should not get messed up so you can provide me medical care, which, you know, those kinds of things. And then one of the things that you said, it was a couple professors of mine, and my kind of deconstruction of that same thing started in college. And I was writing a paper. I was doing a research project on disorders, especially eating disorders. And I was doing this maneuvering not to say white women like experience eating disorders at a higher rate. And this is in the early 2000s, before the specifically height of social media kind of leveled those out a little bit. And I was like doing this work, not to say it. And my white professor was like, are you talking about white women? And I was like, yes. Can I write that down on a piece of paper? Because, you know, like sometimes we just know where, as Black people, where the electric fence is. Like, we know not to cross certain boundaries because we've saw somebody else do it and this happened to us. So when you're talking about that, I think it's so interesting how we have to have whether it's come to Jesus or come to universe moments where we're like, am I going to let them kill me, or am I killing myself? Am I going to be true to myself? Am I going to deny myself? All of those things. So it really, and one of the things that you said that really made me think and made me want to ask you more, a little more about is, so you talk about that process, but how did, and this is a little bit off of the radical self-love, but more into the Black AF, queer AF, is how did you make that transition into living in the body of a Black person for yourself, as you talked about? Because, girl, I was wearing the popped collars. I was more Aeropostale than I was Banana Republic, because that's what I could afford. But I was that girl too. I had a popped collar, and mine was less, it was more a vest, less a blazer, and more that belt that we wore at all the way up under our boobs. Yep. And wedges.
Wait. Do you want to hear something horrifying? And this is high school, but so I went to boarding school, so I had to wear a polo shirt every day. And I think about this a lot, unfortunately. Like, you know, when you can't sleep, you think about all the terrible things you've done. I think about this moment. I had this like really beige, not beige, but it was like a really light pink distressed polo. It was slightly distressed. But when you popped the collar, it said preppy in rhinestones.
Oh, God. That's really bad.
And I remember it was like $150 and I begged my mother for it. And she was like, are you sure? And I was
like, me wearing baby fat, like me wearing a J-Lo coat or a baby fat. And sometimes two polos with a pop collar to make that difference.
Oh, thank God that phase is over. Wow.
I mean, just wait. I'm sure we'll see it at Target soon. I saw something that was like dressed over
kids
jeans.
Kids are wearing that stuff for Halloween this year, just so you know. Be warned.
Cosplaying us. But yeah, so how did you stand in and live in your Blackness as you came out at 25? So how did you make that process happen for self?
Well, I think first of all, I had to like shred all of the stereotypes that I had really like absorbed about Blackness, about everyone. And I was like, you just gotta go figure out like what you want to wear and like what you want to look like, because that I think is something that I struggled with a little bit, is the way that Blackness was emulated to us in the media was like just not how I ever presented. And then it took me a very long time to be like, oh, that's not actually how most of us present. That's just like how the media wants us to be perceived. And so I spent a lot of time like, you know, going back and forth with how I dress. It turns out I really only wear athleisure clothes anyway. So I went through a ton of hair colors, red, pink, like the whole gambit before I landed here on blue. But a lot of it was just, again, getting really good at looking at myself in the mirror. And I don't just mean looking at my face. I mean, looking at my body and understanding that even if other people don't think my body is cool, like I have to be good with this body because it's the only one I've got. I spent a lot of time just thinking about body neutrality, especially because like at the end of the day, like I am not shaped like a white woman. I am not built like a white woman. And I struggled really hard with that for a really long time. Not just with me, like trying to explain that to a doctor, I am never going to make sense on the BMI because I have boobs and hips and a whole butt. I got two whole butt cheeks. And the BMI accounted for none of that. Because when I left that relationship, I was the skinniest I've ever been. I was so unhealthy. I was severely anemic. I'm still severely anemic. But like my hair was falling out. And I weighed 150 pounds. And according to the BMI, that is obese. I was wearing a size 0. And so to explain that to a doctor, you just like, their brain is like, have you thought about dieting? And you're like, I literally will, I'll disintegrate. And so that was something that I really struggled with. I struggled more with the body stuff than anything else. I've always kind of been like weird and like quirky. And so like, it wasn't weird for my parent, well, my dad a little bit, but like when I started getting tattoos and piercings and hair color, my mom was like, yeah, that tracks, like welcome. Cause I think she always expected that of me because my parents always encouraged me to be Black. Like my dad was like, you cannot continue to act like this. Cause if you run your mouth with a cop and you get pulled over, like, it's not going to be like running your mouth with us. And so, I don't know. It just took a lot of self-examination. And I'm going to be like honest, it wasn't fun or comfortable or something that like was a good time. It was really hard because I had to not only unpack all of the terrible shit I thought about myself, but it also meant I thought that terrible shit about other people. And so I really had to unpack how I've caused harm. And that's really hard for humans because we're really painted this picture, like either you're a good human or you're a bad human, and it's very black and white and it leaves no room for nuance. And so I really had to unpack that, like, you're not either a good human or a bad human. You're just like a human who will do good things and you'll do bad things. And that for me was hard because no one wants to learn that they've caused that kind of harm, not only to others, but also, you know, essentially myself as well.
Yeah. You know, it's I could probably do this just forever. I was kind of thinking of some of the things you said. I'm like, yep, had to do that. Yeah, I'm not saying our stories mirror each other at all. It's just the incidence of undoing societal pressures on a Black body is like we all go through that. And I mean, I'm both Black parents, grew up in what we would call the inner city or the hood, and still unpacking those same things because I was going to college and I was different and I was accepting that I was different because I'm different than them. And then that unpacking that elitism that lives with all of those things. And then seeing that they don't see me the same way. There's a really great documentary, and I am like parasocial Facebook friends with the creator called Prep School Negro. And it's about a Black man who went to Germantown Friends, one of those friends schools in Philadelphia, and his experience with not being connected to home anymore and also not being connected to school because he was so different at school, but he was so, and how he did, I would say, venture to say how he didn't end up like Clarence Thomas, but you know, whatevs. So it's so interesting when you talk about that experience, because when you first started talking about your story, the image that I got was like, whenever you see a genie come out of a bottle, we always go, how did their whole body fit into that bottle? But we all contort ourselves in that way to be able to fit whatever the mold is. And sometimes even less so, so that we can even grow in that space. So I think about that. Mel, I was about to cut you off. I was going to do some of the defining of radical self-love.
But so I'll give you a great segue. I'll set it up for you. So Madison, as you're speaking, we've been doing this a long time and we love working together. So it's always fun. We can like tag team. As you're speaking, Madison, I am just struck by a couple of things that you're saying. First of all, radical self-love, I think, is way more of a choice than people realize. I think the perception is that it just is easy for some people to love themselves and they just go around flitting around, do that. For you, and I think for a lot of other people, it had to be an actual conscious choice and not even one that you can make overnight. It was a series of choices that took a long time and it was uncomfortable and it was hard to decide that. That's the first thing that I'm hearing you say. The second thing I'm hearing you say is that there is a really strong connection between radical self-love and saying no to things. The minute you started saying, no, I'm not going to change my hair, I'm actually going to be proud of the fact I'm going to market myself as a blue-haired person who does work in the world. The minute you say no, that's when you claim your power. And claiming your power is the same as radical self-love. Not too much power. You're not trying to lord over other people or give away your power, but you're trying to have the right amount of power for yourself as an individual and as a person, as a in all the identities that you have. Radical self-love is saying no and it's claiming your power. Like it kind of can't be divorced from those things, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's one and the same. And I think that's what a lot of people don't realize about radical self-love. So let's dive into what radical self-love is, Tyshel. And Tyshel spent some time finding some quotes from radical self-love pioneers. So that's what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, so I'll start there. But one of the things that we were thinking about is how do we define it? Because radical is often, you know, one of those boogeyman words as well, but radical being leaned into on purpose, right? So that kind of thing. I literally just wrote a text to one of my friends early and I was like, oh, I remember when I was radicalized. And it was like when I was a kid, I'll pull this up I read these things, but I was like, oh, this is when, I went back. I was like, my FBI agent is not going to like that. I just texted that. So I'm going to put back it, accept it into justice. So I'll talk about that in a second. But when I was looking for definitions to define radical self-love, some of the things that came up were accepting yourself, caring, and not that like self-love, like I'm going to go take a bath and with bath salts and music, which also helpful, fantastic, because you get to spend time for yourself, but accepting yourself, caring for yourself, and knowing that you are more than enough and inherently worthy of love, respect, and compassion. And when I have trouble with the word respect, because respect is often used in two ways. I'm going to treat you like a human, or I'm going to treat you like an authority. And this is me going in the direction of treating you like a human, and that you are yourself human. So I'll pull up just a few of the ones that I pulled. So I'm going to start from the bottom because the last one is my favorite. So Maya Angelou, there's only one you in this world, and that's your superpower. You are perfect in your own way and you are worthy of love. So that's three quotes or four quotes by her that I love. And I love Maya Angelou. Marsha P. Johnson, no pride for some of us without liberation for all of us. And this is when we talk about what pride is and not necessarily being proud, but having pride for collective. Bell Hooks, one of the best guides to how to be self-loving is to give ourselves the love we are often dreaming about receiving from others, which this kind of like when your therapist goes, what would you tell a friend in this situation? And you always got the best advice for your friends and never for self. And then the last, and because I love them the most, Audre Lorde, in 1988, the words of, as a rallying cry, it became a rallying cry. Caring for myself is not self-indulgent. It is self-preservation. And that is an act of political warfare. And it remains one of my favorite quotes, my favorite thought processes. So I know, and I'll back, you can back up in Madison. I'd love to hear from you as you were as Mel was talking about the things that you said no to. You had that emphatic, like, yes, it was saying no. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on radical self-love, how you, you know, as you got there and that saying no, that really resonated for you.
So I think if I had to back up and talk about how I define radical self-love, and I think that I think it's very personal to everyone, but for me specifically, radical self-love for me has been about divesting from capitalism and allowing myself to say no, but whilst divesting from capitalism, also still recognizing that I am deserving of nice things, nice situations, softness. And sometimes softness does look like a bath and a glass of wine and like maybe some like soft music. But sometimes softness means I'm going to therapy. Sometimes softness means I'm not going to work today. Sometimes softness means I'm going to buy myself something really freaking nice because I deserve it. And so that for me, I think has been really empowering because I was always in this mindset of like, well, if I work this hard, I can have this thing. And I no longer look at life transactionally. I have tried really hard, especially for me, to step out of this like scarcity mindset where I'm scared to buy things because I'm so scared of not having that money in my account or whatever it is. I think we're really taught to believe that like you work and you just save and then you die. And I don't want to die with a bunch of money. I want to die with a bunch of experiences and maybe a nice handbag or two. But for me, when I think about radical self-love, I think the other really important part is not just radically loving the parts of me that make me comfortable and that I'm willing to show to the world. Radical self-love for me has been loving the really shitty parts of me, the worst things I've ever done, the best things I've ever done, the things that keep me up at night, and knowing that like my trauma, because there's a lot of it, is also still worthy of that love. And something I've also really had to learn, it was hard because there are parts of myself that I hated for a really long time, specifically the person I was when I was dating him. But I am so grateful for that version of me because that version of me kept me alive. And so for me, radical self-love is being able to love every version of myself, even when that version isn't the version that I aim to be today, because she is why I'm here today. Mm-hmm. And so for me, radical self-love is understanding that you are fully whole. And that is not changed because parts of you, you feel are shadowy or shameful. Or when you think about them, you get that like feeling at the pit of your stomach when you think about them. Because we all have that. We all have that thing that we like keep tucked under our bed. I would say the things I have kept tucked under my bed are truly why I can be this person today. And so I don't shy away from that anymore. Mm.
I felt like I was like, I just sat back in my chair, like, yeah. And it's odd. I love that thought process of loving your whole self in all of the different parts, because that's what, I mean, I've struggled with weight my entire life. And that's one of the things I tell myself, like, I lost all of this weight, 40, almost 50 pounds during the, right before the pandemic. And then the pandemic happened, started, I won't say it happened as if it's over, but it started and I started to slowly put it all back on. But I'm like, that body kept me safe during a pandemic, kept me alive during a global pandemic. And I want to thank that person, these arms, these all of the things, because I won't have them in the same way throughout my entire life. Because we all go through changes through life. So as Black people say in the church, that was a word. That was a word. So thank you for that, Mel. Because I'm just going to get caught up in all of the things that Madison is sharing.
There's so much here. No, there's so much here. It's I'm really glad that you read those quotes, Tyshel, because I do think it's so important to highlight, like over highlight, overemphasize that this movement of radical self-love was pioneered by queer and people of color, specifically trans women, lesbians, queer women of color, and Black women. And the reason I say that is because radical self-love, in my understanding, is different than self-esteem. It's different than like, oh, you get a participation trophy just because you're a special flower. There's a political element to this. There's a political element of resisting structures of oppression in many different forms. And I think about, so I'm bi, so I'm, you know, identify with the queer community. And I think about pride and how much I've learned from queer people and trans people about pride and being proud of yourself and resisting specifically like fundamentalist religious understandings of sexuality. You know, that's my theology. My background is theology and fundamentalism, and how much self-loathing and self-hatred and internalized homophobia there is for queer people. And pride and radical self-love in the queer spaces is an active resistance against those structures that seek to eliminate and exterminate the existence of minority groups. So when you're standing up and saying, no, I refuse to participate in that structure, I'm going to be proud of myself, I'm going to accept myself, and I'm going to proclaim myself as worthy. Like Audre Lorde said, it's self-preservation. We have a right to exist. You don't get to decide who gets to exist on this planet. You're not the decider. I'm the decider because I exist in this body. And when we do that, you know, there's a political element, whether we like it or not, you know, so we might as well embrace it. But it does kind of suck, for lack of a better term, that some people, depending on the body that they're born into, their body becomes political, whether they like it or not. And their self-love has to be political, whether they like it or not, right? That sucks. That's extra work that marginalized people have to do in order to self-exist and self-preserve. So I can keep talking about that. But I'm sure you both have lots to jump in and say here.
There's just so much. And I think what you're sharing is, and one of the things I pulled away from all of those, even what you're saying, Mel, is this journey. Like life is this real under, and like not just life is a journey, but like understanding that it's a journey and understanding that the journey is not linear and that the journey is up and down. And I always say, like, I don't love to use the term success because I think success is what happens when people conflate joy with capitalism, that like that's what success is. Right. So I don't love the term success, but like it's not linear. It's up, it's down, it's back, it's forward. It's all of those things. And we are all on a journey. So like I'm not some all knowing, and at work there at my job, they call me a SME, the subject matter expert. And I'm like, yeah, but also like I got shit to learn. And I my best and loving way of learning it and to get to my radical self-love and joy is learning from the people who live it, but not in a voyeuristic way, but in a communal sense of being able to engage. And I think that was another part of radical self-love, that you have to embody it, and then you get to share it in communities with others as we're all, and not in a way, not in a, we're all really perfect people sitting in this room, but we're all like messy as fuck as well. And we're all learning and living and engaging together. So that exists too. So I think I'm looking at the questions and I'm like, yes. So this is one of the questions, and I think it's a little reductive, I think it's funny, but I want to hear your thoughts on it, Madison. There's like, do you find joy to be easy? And now that you are in where you are in at life and you've done so much of the work, do you find it to be easy? Does it come to you easy?
No, because I deeply struggle with the concept of rest. And I don't think you can have radical self-love without being okay with rest. And rest is absolutely a practice. And it is a huge part of capitalism, especially as a Black woman, to feel like I'm consistently racing up against my last achievement. And so I constantly feel like if I am idle, then I am losing like the battle. Like I'm soon going to be forgotten because I'm only as good as the last great thing I did. And so I really struggle to be idle. And so I got a review last year, and my boss is a white man. And like one of his pieces of feedback to me was like, you need to be off when you're off and you're really bad at it. He was like, if you get an email, you like immediately respond. He was like, holy shit, turn off your phone. And it is just something that I have always been bad at. That's why I have my hands in like 5 different businesses, because I feel an immense pressure to do that. And I think piece of it is being a Black woman, piece of it is capitalism, piece of it is like I'm an only child, and there's a weird amount of pressure that comes with being an only child. Like you have to be the best at everything because there's literally only you. And those are all things that I'm still trying to unpack. Like even one of the things that for me is still like weird to talk about with like the universe is like, I'm a woman who doesn't want children. And then trying to also explain why I care about like building a life that I love, because people are always like, well, you have no one to give it to at the end. And that's always like a weird conversation to have, is like, I'm building this life for me. I'm building community for me. Mostly because I know that children aren't something that I've ever wanted. but it's still really weird to be in my 30s and like explain that to people and then be like, you hate children. When a lot of it is, again, because I am trying to divest from capitalism and value rest. Those are not typically things you also get to do fully if you choose to have children. It becomes incredibly hard. And so, no, it is not easy because there are ways that some level of traditionalism feels normal. And so you see, okay, like for example, I'm watching Love is Blind right now. I don't know if you watch Love is Blind. It's super trashy, super messy. I find myself like during those shows being like, well, what if your life looked like this? And not with a man, but like currently, you know, like I just think you're constantly thinking about it because you see it reflected to you. And so you spend a lot of time thinking about like, well, what if my life looked like that? Even though you know that it's not a life that feels desirable, it feels like it should feel desirable. The same way thinness, I don't desire thinness, but I feel like I should desire thinness. And that's actually where I struggle, whereas I know I don't want these things, but then I struggle because I feel like I should. And so not easy.
It's so funny that you said, I'm also watching Love is Blind, and this is the most hot mess season I've ever seen at all. And me and my husband watch it together, and we're both like, they don't need to be in a relationship. They need to all be in therapy.
Oh my God, that's what I said. I was like, y'all don't need to be in a pod. You need to be with a therapist. And that's okay. But oh my God.
It's scripted. None of it's real. Come on.
And that's the other thing.
I don't watch it, but I can tell you this for sure.
So they script the situations, not the language, but in editing, they decide who's who. So we don't get to see the full person. And I think that's so interesting because, and I have a friend who is a producer and she's gotten to produce, or an old classmate of mine, I don't want to say friend to like misrepresent, but who's produced Love is Blind and Married at First Sight and things like that. And I, you know, so it's a TV show and people mostly go in there because they want to be on TV. This is funny because I just happened the other day that I got contacted in my DMs, because now that's exactly where people contact you for all kind of anything. And it's like, before you'd be like, you're contacting me, that sounds not legitimate, but now it's like a legitimate way to contact people. To be on a reality TV show talking about being in an interfaith relationship, because me and my husband are different, have different faith or belief system backgrounds. And I was like, that sounds really interesting. My husband was like, no, I do not want to be in front of the he's not that person. He would not be good at it. And then me and my best friend, I was talking to my best friend about it because she also watches like Real Housewives or whatever. And she's like, my mouth is too reckless to be on that show. I'm absolutely going to be the villain because I just don't know what the fuck to say when I'm by myself or when I'm in a group of other people. She's like, and sometimes she works in corporate America. She's like, and we're from Philadelphia. She'd be like, sometimes I got to leave a Philly in the car. Cause like you can't go up and then go pop it off. And I was like, you can, you just gotta give it to, you know. So I understand that joy is not easy for any of us. And it is also a journey, and like not to be hard on your, cause this is what my therapist says to me all the time. And this is my, and so I'll make sure I tag her to watch this one. So she knows that I am practicing what she told me, which she like, whenever I say I'm going to be okay. And she goes, yeah, but it's okay if you're not as well. Like I went into therapy, was like, I want a goal. And she was like, maybe no, not giving you a goal. The goal is to just be. And I was like,
no, it's too much.
What am I paying you for? I'm paying you to tell me what I want to hear. And she's like,
I want to get things
no.
done. I don't want to just be.
I would also argue that I think if joy feels easy, then it's probably surface level. Because there are things that make you really happy. Like, yeah, Crab Rangoon makes me happy. It's so a nice bag makes me happy. But happy and joy are not the same emotion, despite they are presented as synonyms.
I was thinking about this the other day. Like, I think joy is more like what gets you through the hard times. And people think of happiness as the absence of hard times, but joy is the sustaining force that gets you through it. It's like, it's almost like it's not real until it's put to the test.
And that's why I say what I say about success, because people are like, I'm so successful. They're so successful. And I'm like, okay, but are they even joyful, happy? Do they care about other things outside of like the title that they're given? And what, and so like, I work in corporate America as well. And I haven't been there for a long time, but like I came into corporate America not climbing the corporate ladder. I'm not gonna listen, I grew up poor, so I'm not around here to turn down anything but my collar. So if you want to give me more money, you want to give me a high title, sure, but I'm not going to, because my thought process about climbing the corporate ladder is I'm not climbing over myself or other people to get there. Like, I just refuse to do it because that creates, especially for Black people, crabs in a barrel where I have to push you down so that I can be at the top. And then I have to, and if the door opens for me, I have to jimmy it shut behind myself so that they know I'm the only one, because if you're special and I'm special, then who's special? And that is just, you know, recreating the white supremacist construct that white people already live in. And then we just buy into and understanding where, like, I just started playing tennis this year, wanted to play tennis for years, but I waited until I figured out whether I was doing it because it was a white fancy sport or I actually thought it was fun to do. And now I'm on the court and I'm like, my husband's like, it's literally not how you play. You need to relax. And I'm like, okay, but I love it now. And maybe I would have loved it then, but now I can enjoy it because I'm doing it just for fun and not to like put a what do they call it? A Vineyard Vine sweater on and be a part of the fun white club. Right. So I love that. And thank you for your honesty. Go ahead, Mel. You were about to say something.
I was just going to say last question, because I know we're getting close to time. Do you both think that there's a connection between radical self-love and empathy? Mm. And here's the reason I asked this question, because actually I think like a year ago, Tyshel, you and I contacted Tyshel because I wanted to make a TikTok video about like how white people need to just stop being so freaking selfish. And Tyshel said, I don't agree with you. I was like, what do you mean you don't agree with me? White people are the most selfish people on the planet, as speaking as a white person. And she goes, her answer floored me, like absolutely floored me. Tyshel said, I don't think white people need to be less selfish. I think they need to practice more self-love. And I was like, what? Like what? but that answer was so wise, because real self-love, when it's deep and when it's joyful, it's connected to other people, right? You can't just be self-loving on an island. Real self-love, true self-love is an antidote for selfishness. I've been thinking about that ever since, Tyshel. You like rocked my world. It really,
I was like, I said that?
I think about once a week. About once a week, I think about that when I'm like, I don't know. It's just, I think this is a message that everybody needs to hear. Not just white people, but everybody. Like, the antidote to selfishness, the antidote to disconnection and isolation and misery and capitalism is not to just say, be less awful, but is to welcome love in, you know? And there's also that saying, you know, like, do unto others as you had them do unto you, or love your neighbor as yourself. Like, there's these ancient teachings from multiple world religions that say there's a connection there between loving yourself and loving other people. And I think a lot of us miss both of those things. And I just wanted to hear from you both. Like, do you see for yourself that there's a connection between radical self-love and empathy? And what does that look like for you?
Madison, take it away. I'd love to hear your thoughts too.
So the first thing I want to say, and it may be like a little like scandalous and spicy, I actually don't view selfishness as like a big negative thing. I think there's worlds in which it can be negative, but I will tell you, like, I am incredibly selfish with my time, with my resources, with who I allow in my spaces. Hmm. And like, I am like radically selfish about those things. And it's funny because one of the pieces of feedback I get about not wanting children is that I'm selfish, and I'm completely okay with that piece of feedback because I am selfish about the things that revive me, that make me feel restored. That being said, I do think there is a ton of linkage. I don't know if that's a word, but there is a link between radical self-love and empathy, because it's funny. One of the things that people always say to me, because I use people's comments to me as content all the time, but I edit out people's names, and people are like, oh, why'd you edit out this person's name? Like, why hide their identity? Because it's not about them. It's about the larger messaging, because if they said it and they felt comfortable to say it on the internet in the year of 2023, it means they're not the only person that thinks this. They were just one dumb enough to say it online. and I empathize with the fact that if you are so comfortable being a dick on the internet, like, you've got other stuff going right. on. Definitely. I never seek out other people to be like, ugh, I hate you, like, on the internet. And I have one guy who literally emails me anonymously, like, twice a week. Twice a week this man emails me. And his email is mysteryman550, like. and I empathize because not only do you have all the time in the world to, like, make a fake email and send me emails, like, I know there are pieces of you that are broken to feel like you need to do that.
Right.
And there's something about you that is fearful. And I think if we're going to talk about white people specifically, I think there is so much fear in not knowing how to not be the dominant identity.
Yeah.
And people act terribly when they feel fear. And that's why when we have these conversations about DEI, about race, they're not political, and people are quick to make them political because that's the only way they know how to argue the point.
That's so well said. Yep. Agreed.
I would echo that. I don't believe that being selfish is terrible. It's only when that selfishness seeps over into hurting someone else that it can become problematic. And if you don't want children, like, why are we telling people to have children who don't want them? Like, I just, that just doesn't make, if I don't want children,
I shouldn't have them.
Right. Every child should be wanted.
Because, and then there's people who have children who are like, I worked at a Montessori school for 8 years, and I was babysitting a kid, and we were in the grocery store. No, I was in the, I was working, this was when I was working at Whole Foods. I was in the grocery store, and there was a mom, and her son was biting her, and she was like, never have children. I was like, not now, and not your child. And I'm also looking at the parent who had the child, because that's also where some of those children's problems started. Yep. Right. And we know, I know that from psychology. But so I think that selfishness is good when it's about you, because if you can take that time, and this is that, like, when you're on a plane, put on your mask first before you put it on a child, is that if you can take that time for yourself, then I have the energy, the for me, rectifying my mouth before the words come out and spill out onto you. And I've thought about them. I have friends who I would, friends now, that I had a friend who, there was sometimes he would say or do something, and I'd be like, what the f-? And then I would be like, okay, but like, how would I say that as a good friend? Right? But that's me having taken the time for myself to think and learn and be, so that I can be a good friend. And that would be, that spills over into being a good partner. Like, for me, and I can only speak for myself in my heteronormative marriage, is that, like, to be a good partner, and this is probably for all, most people who live with somebody else, like, when you live with somebody else and it's constant and you're like, I just want to hit you, but that's not the right thing to do. So let me take some time for myself, or I just want to call you stupid. And my husband is one of the smartest people I've ever met. He's the nicest person I've ever met. But sometimes just being with another person makes you think about, like, you're bothering me or what have you. But so I say all that to say, being empathetic for the folks in your household, then your family, and then your larger community. And community is really how we get around and live through all of these things. But I can't do that if I'm only worried about you and never worried about myself. That's very different than the model that becomes like individualism. And this is why, instead of cherry picking the parts of other faith systems or communities and using their, like, instead, like, how about we pick up the practices that are not yoga, but yoga's great, that are not just yoga, and really pull over the large, like, oh, understanding of peace and love and all of that, instead of cherry picking the things that we like about it, and really understand what their practices are. Like, and I will say, for me, and as a Black person, really looking into not just faith systems, but systems of living as a Black person from African origins really help. And that's not to idealize them and say they are so much better than ours, and there's nothing, you know, but really to be like, it takes a village to raise a child. So maybe I won't have to be a mother who hates everything, hates my time, because I have a village around me. I really want to look at all the things so I look at a lot of those things. So I think it's definitely connected to empathy, because if I can take time for myself, then I can give you the best of me, and then I can help you, and we can help each other, because we're still, like I said, on a journey. So all that to say, Madison, you said it absolutely, all of those things. We could probably carry it's all, and we went way over the time I had even said to you. So thank you for being so gracious with your time, so open and vulnerable. Thank you for sharing your story. Yes. Thank you for being vulnerable with our audiences about your experiences. But that probably takes a lot of self-healing, because at some point you're probably not telling that story to everybody because you were living that story. So I just say thank you. But in all of the things, and I don't know if Mel has another question or something she wants to say, but I really want to give you the floor to, like, promote anything you have going on, but promote how you're living and what is important to you, what's top of mind, what's going on for you. But say thank you. You lived up to all my thought processes, but also there were none, but like also all of them.
I am notoriously bad at like selling and advertising myself. So instead, what I am going to say is, if you take anything away from having this conversation and me like talking a lot and talking in the lens of like ADHD, where I go several directions at multiple times, if the thing you take away is anything, please let it be that this is everyday work for the rest of your life. You don't just like pull over one day, get out of the car, and you're like, I'm here. Radical self-love. I made it. You're going to do things that you hate for the rest of your life. You're going to look back at things 10 years from now, 20 years from now, and be like, I can't believe I did that. I'm so ashamed. You're going to do things that you love for the rest of your life. You're going to have big belly laughs and heartbreak and all the mess forever. And so on the days where it's really hard and you feel like you're not doing it right, there will be more days. There will be better days. There will be worse days. And for me, that has been the most important part, is there is no day that I am like the Mother Teresa of radical self-love and I've made it and I have ascended. There's just me trying to get through it every day, one day at a time. And that's all we've got, is ourselves and our willingness to believe that like I am deserving of this work. And so if you take anything away from this, please know that like it's really hard and it will always be hard, but it's worth it.
That there's no more that needs to be said. That's the perfect way to end. So thank you so much, Madison. I'm so inspired by your work and thankful for your time. And it's been really just absolutely lovely having you on the show. So thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Yay.
Awesome. So we're going to let Madison go. I know we are not like, we run a good operation, but a professional one. It's very casual. So we're going to let Madison go. Thank you and say thank you. And then we'll talk a little bit and bring on our producer. So again, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for being here. Thank you for everything.
You shine so brightly. It's awesome.
I try my best. Have a great rest of your night, y'all.
You too. Bye-bye.
Whoa.
That was awesome. I feel invigorated.
Right. To like be and invigorated, but also invigorated to do better, be better, feel better, and be myself.
Yes. It's okay to be yourself. Wow. What a novel concept. Look at that.
So I'm going to cancel my therapist for next week. No, I'm not going to do that.
Don't do it. No, you still need therapy.
Well, I love it.
We want to say a great big hearty thank you to our producers, because this is our last episode of season 3. So we're going to bring on our wonderful producers and just have a couple minutes to hang out with them and say thank you and celebrate what has been a freaking awesome season. So we want to say hi to Alicia and Darling and Joe, our three producers here.
Joe was it's so funny. So you can't see Joe right now. I'm sure she'll pop back on, but she was going to, I saw her as we were on with Madison, and she was like eating ice cream, and I was like, yes.
Then she was in her car. I don't know what's going on. Joe, what are you doing?
She's like, I'm somewhere. Yeah, she's like halfway here. But I was like, is she eating ice cream right now? I wish I was eating ice cream right now.
Oh, same.
It's going to be on after this is over.
Yeah. Hey, thank you all so much. I mean, there's been so much work that's been happening behind the scenes that you all don't see, and that our producers help us with show planning and social media and promotion. And we're just so tremendously grateful, because this show wouldn't happen without the three of you.
Thank you. Yeah, you're welcome.
Appreciate it.
So from the background, any thoughts that you'd want to elaborate on from what Madison was sharing? Anything that was top of mind for you as we close out on such another great season?
I really resonate with that last thing that she said about how like this is your life now forever. Like, it's not like one moment. You're not gonna arrive at self-love and it's just going to be smooth sailing here on out. Like, you know, we are human beings who are capable of good and bad things. So, you know, like, you'll still have your rough days. You'll still have the days where, you know, you believe what society has told you, white supremacy, your patriarchy is telling you about yourself. And, you know, and then, you know, you have to give yourself that space to come out of that and, you know, and keep pushing. Like, it's not linear, like most things in life. And so I really believe that, because I live it. Like, you know, it's every day. It's like a job.
Mm-hmm.
It is. No vacation.
I love that.
Yeah.
Alicia, thoughts?
Yeah, for me, it hit right here when both of you, Tasha and Maddie, had talked about, you know, loving all those versions of yourself, even the ones that you're embarrassed about or you are ashamed of, or, you know, they served a purpose, and like, to, it's okay to kind of like love that part of you and like leave it where it's at. But, you know, I don't know. I felt like I needed to hear that. So thanks.
And Joey sees she's got some spotty internet, but she's here. Anything that resonated with you, we'll let you go back on mute in a second. But if you want to share anything that resonated with you from this last, from Madison's conversation. She's like, I don't think so. Technical difficulty.
I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure if y'all were talking to me because I'm just able to connect audio.
Oh, no, I was saying to you, anything that resonated from our interview with Madison that kind of resonated with you?
No, I think this whole conversation around joy and being intentional about what that, like, journey and process will look like. Actually, speaking of joy, I'm en route from ice cream, so I was able to tune in and engage in that way. So.
I think it's a nice reminder,
especially now at this time, to just be a little bit more intentional and prioritize myself as much as I'm showing up and helping others. So I'm really grateful for those reminders.
Awesome. We will mute you, Joe, so we won't. And if you need to drop, let us. That's okay, too. I just wanted to take... I think we lost her again. So I just wanted to take some time, and as Mel started to say, saying thank you to you all, because you do so much, and this, and not just the behind the scenes technical and getting all the info, but like the topics that we talk about, because for show you're right on, as Keith Lee on the internet would say.
It literally start working now.
Oh, it's gotta be there. I'm trying to mute. I can't even mute
it. I left my keys on top of the car.
No, we can hear you.
Yeah, I don't know. We gotta have to remove her or something. But as Keith Lee would say, for sure, you were like, you all come up with topics, and some of the topics I wasn't thinking about, we combine. So all of the things, and this has just been another great season. It's funny because we always there's so much like dread, not dread going into the conversation, but like all the work, all the, because we all have lives and we all do so much. But then when we get here, we're like, yes, conversation is fantastic. And I love that for us. And I'm grateful for you all every single day, because we keep so many connections, not just on this podcast and during the actual broadcast, but, you know, in between times. And we share some, you know, personal successes, spaces that we're taking. Like Joe is very excited to tell us. I also have a therapist now. So I'm like, I love that for her. I was like, and we were saying that before you all jumped on, when it was, I think it was just Joe and I for the first minute or two, you're saying that, you know, this podcast is a labor of love, but you all have been through a lot of transition. Literally, each one of you has moved and changed jobs this year, all three of you. And then Mel has literally been working nonstop since, I don't know, 7 months ago. Like, I don't know what. And you know, I've been through some things, and happy, sad, all of those things. But just time that you all spend and share and give to us, and to put this out there. As one of the folks watching, I know, I was talking to them earlier, and they're like, oh, I listened to your podcast. And I was like, okay, great. They're like, I'll be listening. So I hope she gets from it what she needs as well. And just, we'll always, I think no matter where we go with this actual entity, and this is not like my declaration of signing off forever, but I'm just saying, no matter where we go with this entity, we'll always be able to look back on it and be like, wow, we did all of this. We had all of these great conversations. People were willing to, I reached out to Madison on the internet and she was like, sure. And I was like,
yeah. The guests we've had have been so freaking high quality, wonderful, yes, incredible people with all these amazing accomplishments. I'm like, some of these people we've interviewed have been like, oh my gosh, they want to talk to us? Like, are you kidding?
Yeah. So I'm running for political office, Kasim.
Yeah, it's just been an awesome. And in addition to that, even though that's super impressive and exciting, but it's also the number of times that we've had like a producing meeting and then just kind of like talked about relationships for half an hour. And just, I just want to thank you all for your friendship more than anything else. This has just been a really meaningful project. And I'm just so grateful to just have known each of you. It's just been wonderful.
Yes, I know somewhere in my Brave Space t-shirt, which is like great quality. Love it. But we have a Brave Space retreat coming at some point because we gotta meet up somewhere and like really get together and just hang out in the throes of, if we can ever pry Mel away from Maine or somewhere we can all get together in one point. Because I don't know if she's gonna get me all up in the woods up in whatever in the state of, I don't know, 1,200 people.
We'll have to figure it out.
But yeah, we will. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you for, and this is to our audience, people who listen, who are tuning in live and for who are listening to us in their pockets later or on their computer when they should be working. Do this too, right? It's your self-care, your self-love. But thank you for being here for a third season. So many podcasts don't even make it this far.
No.
So I just want to say thank you. I'm filled with gratitude, and I don't know if I'm gonna eat a salad, but I'm filled with gratitude right now. And maybe I'll eat some broccoli or something, but like, no. You know, maybe I'll order Popeyes and maybe that'll
please. I have coupons. I'm so excited.
Well, thank you all again. Awesome. Have a wonderful, wonderful rest of your evening. And
yes, you too.
Roll that beautiful outro.
Oh, that's right. We have the outro video. Bye.